parables which each have their own individual lesson. And in many ways, we want to understand, as we study any parable, some key questions about it. Any of our studies in the Scriptures force us to look at certain questions, one of which is setting. And the first slide here, I've outlined some of these. That one. Questions to ask in our studies. You know, who, what, where, when, and why. If you go back to grade school or whatever, there's key questions about why you're studying something or what you're studying. In order to read a paragraph and know what it means, you've got to look at each of these ideas. Well, as we study the Bible, it's important that we study each of these aspects as well. One of which is timeline. How does a story set in the overall timeline? If we're reading along in a book in the Bible, and we're not paying attention to the timeline, in the Old Testament, it's not that difficult to read a story in one place and think you're in the timeline somewhere else where you're actually not. It's important to place it in context. As Jesus is teaching disciples or teaching the Jews, it's important to know the setting. Who's he speaking to? Is he speaking to Jews? Is he speaking to believers, non-believers, or is he speaking to Samaritans? Who would each have a different interpretation or might receive the word differently than the other group might, because of their upbringing, because of their background, they might look at something a bit differently. They might be biased in a certain way. So, where's the story set? Where does it fit into the Bible timeline? Who's speaking? It's important to understand the tense of who's speaking. Is it Jesus speaking? Is it the Father speaking in certain instances? Those give us an indication of the authority with which the word comes. Is it just an individual speaking with their ideas? Who's being addressed? I've already mentioned that. If it was the Jews versus the Samaritans, they might have a different bias as to how to receive the word. What is being discussed? What's the idea? What's the single most important or set of lessons from a given set of stories? We've emphasized this earlier in some of our studies this quarter already. It's important to pick out the key points. What is being discussed and what's the main point? And why is it being discussed? What's the overall lessons that you want to get out of it? So those are some of the things we'll want to look at today. I've broken this one down into the stories themselves. Now, as we relate to teaching and how we study, presentation matters. I could start out today, and if I was tired and I was sleepy and I was groggy, well, let's open our Bibles today and let's turn to this first passage. And let's just start reading it. Without giving any sense of a real interest in the study or what my main goal is in trying to impart to you in the lesson today. So we have an influence on how well our students will receive our lessons. You may get that from me one day. I may come in. I may not be that alert and I may not be that ready. But it's important for us to at least prepare mentally and be ready to do that so that we can impart to our students in the best possible way that they will receive it and learn from it. Today's summary of the different ones I've tried to break down, and starting in Luke 14, 1 through 6, we have a response by Jesus to those that are criticizing him for healing on the Sabbath. Have we already studied this before in another location? Has he been criticized before for healing on the Sabbath? Okay. You want to engage your students. I'm engaging you now. Okay. Jesus was eating in the home of one of the chief Pharisees. And as a result, an opportunity presented itself. There was a man there that was present as well that was had the dropsy. And dropsy being one of it, he was not able to get up or down. Jesus posed the question now, as he had been confronted before, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? He used this as a teaching opportunity. Would the Pharisees respond? Well, okay, they didn't respond. Now, why did they not respond? We mentioned one of our questions before. Why? Why would they have not responded at this point? What position would it have put them in? They would have had to go on contrary to what they were already condemning him for earlier. Okay? Jesus, after healing the man, responded, which of you, having an ass or an ox fallen into a pit, will not go straightway and pull him out on the Sabbath? That was allowed in the law. And as a result, he convicted them without having to confront them. They couldn't respond to it. They basically put this issue to bed at this point. That's the point out of this particular section of stories, is Jesus, in teaching them, used the law itself and how he approached them to basically put an overall issue to bed. Saying here, the text says they no longer confronted him on this particular matter. In Luke 7, we begin the study of a number of the parables. And it starts out a very short one here. It addresses those that are seeking preeminence. Now, we could title this a bit differently, potentially. I chose to use the idea of preeminence. And the parable as it relates here is, there's more than one, but in this particular one, 8 through 11, it looks at there's a feast or a wedding in which an individual might be drawn into. And he uses this parable to draw an illustration to them. At the feast or wedding, the individual might come in and has an opportunity to sit in different places. Now the Jews were known for what? Having chief seats, having places where they would recognize someone more importantly than another. As he instructs the individuals, he says, if you come into this wedding feast and you go in and you seek a seat of higher setting than potentially your place will be, what might be the outcome? Might be asked to move. Because there might be someone that comes in that's more important. What do you say would happen to you if that did happen? Be ashamed because of that. So he instructed them not to seek the place of preeminence, but to seek what? Seek a lower place. And as a result, if indeed no one did come in that was to be elevated more than they, they would be brought forward and given a seat of preeminence. Now, there's a broader lesson in this as well. It's one about not thinking of oneself more highly than you does. It's a lesson on how we are to be humble. He was teaching the Pharisees in and of themselves. First off, by using this illustration, here's some practical application for you to save yourself some grief and shame. But, more importantly, don't think more highly of yourself than you do. Okay? Very good. Very good application in comparison with that particular passage. Any other comments? Okay? Our next parable is one of choosing guests for a feast. In Luke 14, 12 through 14. Very short passage. And again, one might look at this entire chapter out of Luke and say, well, what's the purpose of these? Giving very pointed lessons to the Pharisees, trying to convict them or convince them to look inwardly and what they've been doing and what they need to be doing. So he uses another short story here, another parable, choosing guests for a feast. I'm going to read this one quickly. When you makest a dinner or a supper, call not thy friends or thy brethren, neither thy kinsmen nor thy rich neighbors, lest they also bid thee again, and recompense be made unto thee. But when you makest a feast, call the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind, and thou shalt be blessed, for they cannot recompense thee, for thou shalt be recompensed at the resurrection of the just. Okay, is he saying you can't have your friends over for dinner? No. What's the point out of this? Well, the point in this particular parable is one of which you really need to be not having feast with the expectation of a reward now, but having a feast for the purpose of benefiting someone else. He was wanting them to benefit the people that could not repay anything back by comparison. The Jews were known to stand on the street corners and want to be recognized by men. Might very well have a feast just to be recognized by somebody that's coming to his feast. It was not the point that he was trying to make. He was trying to make the point here. You need to be doing things, not going to be trying to seek something in return for it. Okay. Luke 14, 15 through 24 is a parable of the Great Supper. Now, this has a number of applications. But the story is one of where there is to be a great feast. And the master calls for individuals to come and has sent out, apparently, invitations in advance. And there have been those that have accepted those invitations. So maybe they did their RSVP earlier and the master is ready for the feast now and he's going out reminding everybody it's time to come into it. And people start responding, What did they respond? There's three noted responses listed. Okay? What's the first one? I bought a piece of land, and I need to go and look and reprove it. Well, is that land going to be gone tomorrow? It'll be there tomorrow. It'll be there the day after, whatever. What was the next response? I bought a yoke of oxen, and I've got to go out and prove them. Okay. Well, could you not prove them tomorrow? And it starts to relate to an idea of also priorities here. Where were their priorities? What did the people really want to do? They were avoiding their obligations. What was the third one? I got married. I'm not coming to your feast. I just got married. Well, he had already had an obligation. And Granny's got a big obligation now. But still had obligations to fulfill. Even though the Jewish tradition was that after they got married, they were off for a year. And they were supposed to spend that time with their companion. But they had an obligation that they had signed up for. They didn't do it. Now, what did the master respond? Was he happy? Not in the least. He was furious. What did he tell his servants to go out and do? Previous parable was talking about it. Now, the master had invited people, potentially, that he might have expected to have responded back in some way and returned his favor as well. But now, he's going out and doing what? He's applying the principle that Jesus points out in the previous parable, and he goes out and starts talking to who? The sick, the maimed, the blind? Okay? The poor, the people that could do nothing for him, and he says, bring them in, fill it up. And in the first round of guests that's invited, do they fill up the feast? No. What does he tell them to go do now? Go find more. Go out in the highways and the byways and bring them in. Now, the master would have had absolutely no expectation of what might have come in here. But indeed, the feast was filled, and they did continue on to have the feast. The conclusion on verse 24, for I say unto you that none of those men which were bidden shall taste of my supper. Now, that's in the one that's speaking here. It's the conclusion to that parable, but it's the master speaking. If we make application, we can make application on several levels. This master learned the lesson and appropriately applied the previous instructions. But if Jesus is teaching the Jews here now, thinking about the audience, what audience had the word been extended to? Opportunity been extended to over and over again? Jews. Had they made excuses over and over again for not following those opportunities? Yes, they did. What's the conclusion for the rejection of those opportunities? Not going to get to partake in the feast. Okay? Now, that's a subtle underlying lesson. You have to apply it to the people that are there present, and the audience that's present listening to it. Okay, any comments on the parable of the Great Supper? Absolutely. Agreed. And sets the tone for it immediately. There were those that still there in that audience that I don't think really understood what the kingdom was. But yes, that is the response. Cost of discipleship is continuation in verse 25 through 35. And there's multiple explanations here that are given about the cost of discipleship. It's not just one single parable, it's more of a series of points to help one understand considering the cost. To start with, in verses 26 through verse 27, if any man come to me and hate not his father and his mother, wife, children, brethren, and sisters, yea, his own life, also he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. What points is Jesus trying to make to those that are listening to him at this point? Not going to be easy. It's going to be a price to be paid. What price did the apostles pay? Some had already left their livelihoods. Ultimately, what price did the majority of the apostles pay? They gave their lives. They were persecuted. They were killed. Now, other disciples, Stephen was stoned. This is setting the tone for things that people would have to endure. Now, what did the apostles do? Well, many of them left their livelihoods. Many had already left their families. It's unlikely that many of the apostles ever went back and had the same relationship with their families that they probably did before. We know that there were those that, because of choosing to serve, they were cast out of the synagogue. And as a result, there was a price to be paid. Point he's making here, there is a cost of discipleship. They couldn't have it both ways. They couldn't have one foot in Judaism over here and trying to maintain allegiances and alliances in Judaism be a Christian. Okay, he uses illustrations to help make his point here. In verse 28 through verse 30, he makes a point or an illustration about an individual going out to build a tower. And does a man go out and start to build a tower without considering the cost first? Well, he says, well, no. And why does he say that? What's the fear that's going to be in that person of doing that? May not be able to finish it. Well, laugh at him. That's the main point I want to say out of that. Yeah, he may not be able to finish it, but what was going to be the stinging result of that? People would laugh at him, be ridiculed over it. Okay? And verses 31 through 33, the illustration is used about considering the cost again, and this time, instead of a tower, it's using the idea of going to war. And a king with 10,000 men has to consider whether he goes to war with a man who has, or a king that has how many? 20,000. So a king that's much more powerful than him, he has to consider whether he's going to go out and seek him in battle. And as he considers that, what does he end up coming to the conclusion of? The smart man, he does what? Sends a delegate in advance and seeks a way to find peace. Because what would the war cost him if he went to battle? Could cost him everything. So the king had to consider, what's it worth now? Is it worth me finding a way to be in peace and maintaining a portion of this, or is it worth the loss of everything? That illustration, or the point of that, is not anything more, any deeper than, okay, you need to consider the cost. Same way with the tower, need to consider the cost. And he was instructing those that were following him, there will be a cost, you have to consider it, and don't be caught off guard when there is a cost associated with it. Yes? Right. Well, and taking it in the context of this, it's associated with the cost. There were those who, by choosing to follow Jesus, would no longer be with their families. And I think, I was trying to emphasize the cost, but that is a good point. It is, because someone could read this and say, well, have I got to hate my parents to be able to be a Christian? Well, no. The point is you've got to find a way to love God and do what He's asking for, but there may be sacrifices that come about as a result of that. Brent? Well, we have a similar account when Jesus was walking and asking those to follow Him. What did one respond to Him? I need to go and bury my father first. What did He respond back? Let the dead bury the dead. You bring in those parallel accounts as well. What was most important at that time was to follow Christ. And there were going to be sacrifices associated with it that family members might not like. Thank you for your comments. Anything else? Okay. Kingdom parables and parables of the lost sheep start with chapter 15. And again, it's important to know the context. Who is he in the midst of here in verse 1 of chapter 15? Tax collectors. And who else is there watching in verse 2? Pharisees. Okay, now, did those groups like each other? What did they represent? Tax collectors and the publicans represented the Roman government and the oppression upon the people. Pharisees and leadership represented Jewish nation and what they really wanted to be. Now, the tax collectors and publicans also, as a result of their relationship with the Romans, represented a group of individuals who, in general, are trustworthy, who sought to oppress the people and take from them as much as they could and over-exact taxes, because if they got what? They got a percentage. The more I collect, the more I get. They weren't trusted. Okay. Pharisees murmured, saying, this man receives sinners with them, and Jesus starts responding back. This is the context, and he starts responding back with these parables. Now, the parables point out key aspects about what Jesus is considering. In that, okay, God seeks that all be saved. He rejoices when one returns, and jealousy is not an acceptable response. What was the first of the parables? First parable was, man having 100 sheep and one is lost. What does he do? Leaves the 100, or leaves the 99, and he goes forward to look and find that one sheep, and brings it back on his shoulders and rejoices at its return. Making the parallel to who he's in the context of with the groups there, Jesus is teaching the sinners there of the publicans and the tax collectors, and he is excited if any one of them responds and returns to that word and follows him. Verse 7 makes that point clear. And I say unto you that likewise joy shall be in heaven over one sinner that repenteth more than over 99 just persons which need no repentance.
So, well, why wouldn't you rejoice over the 99? What? You're excited and you're glad that there's nothing changed there, but you're more excited that someone has joined the ranks of those that are saved. Doug?
That's a good point as well. Okay. Verse 8. Every time I read this, I visualize the story as if it's destitute person, in many cases, who only has limited resources. Somehow they've lost what could be a significant portion of their livelihood. And it helps me put this in greater context. Either what woman, having 10 pieces of silver, if she lose one piece, doth not light a candle and sweep the house and seek diligently till she find it? When she hath found it, she calleth her friends and her neighbors together, saying, Rejoice with me, for I have found the piece that I had lost. Likewise I say unto you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that repenteth. One could tie to this a number of things in history. The dowries that individuals would receive. One might be looking at this. This is an important part of what has been passed down to that individual, and now they've lost it. They review it as a key or an essential loss in something that was given to them. It could be that this is a destitute person and they've lost a tenth of their entire income and earnings that they might need to be able to survive. But yet, the emphasis is not on the physical here. It's on the spiritual application. The spiritual application is on the rejoicing for the one that has returned, rejoicing for that which has been found. And that leads us into the parable of the prodigal son. This is a fantastic story orally tell. So you study it, and be able to recite it, and give them the emphasis of what that story really means to both the sons and the father that was involved and how they interacted. The story begins with a family. And we have a father of the characters that sit in that as the father and the two sons. Beginning of the story, we don't even notice that there is another son, but we do see that the father and the youngest son interact. And the youngest son comes to the father and he asks, Father, I want you to give to me what that which is due me. This is much like, okay, give me my inheritance now. And that would be a rather odd request. You know, we see in the relationship of Jacob and to his sons, Isaac, in his relationship to his sons Jacob and Esau. The passing of the blessings did impart some level of the family property transferring early on before the actual death. And this is an instance where we may see that same type of application. The young son's coming in, he's asking, give me this now. Was it right for him to do that? To ask him for something in advance of when it should have been due. Now, the father, though, had the option to make a change in his plans here, and he, as a result, he goes about and he does give the son his entire inheritance. Is the son grateful? What does he go out and do with his inheritance? He goes out and wastes it. Well, did he do it there in the presence of everybody that loved him and cared for him? What was the setting? Well, it says he went away into a faraway land and he wasted his inheritance upon riotous living. Well, that story will be told over and over at times and tied to it, but the passage here doesn't relate to this about any other friends or anything else. Yeah. Were there any other individuals interacting here? The son's the one that's just wasted it. What happens now? Famine that comes about. Famine that comes to the land and, you know what? He didn't have anything for food. He has to go to work. He has to go to work in a way that a Jew would have found to be reprehensible. What does he end up doing to try and feed himself? Feeding the hogs. Well, what's so special about that? Pigs were unclean animals, not only physically but spiritually to the Jews. And this would have been like the most abhorrent thing that a Jew could consider doing. But to take it one step further, what was even worse about that? What was he willing to do? He was willing to eat what they would eat. What conclusion did that young son come to? Say about the servants of his own father. They're better off. They have more food than even I could. And they're treated better
that even the hired servants are treated better. What conclusion does he come to at that point? I'll go back and I'll work for my father as a servant. And I'll tell him I'm sorry. And he responds back and he goes. And as he's approaching his home, what happens? Father sees him a way off. Now, have to think from a father's standpoint. Imagine the father stood there every day looking down the road occasionally, you know, hoping that one day that son would return. Tie that aspect of it in, depending on obviously the age group that you have, those that are in the group that have parents or that are parents will very much relate to that idea. That father's looking down that road, he sees the son coming back. Well, does he go back into the tent and just sit there and wait for him? No. He runs to him, he kisses him, and what other things does he set in motion? He puts a robe on him. He treats him as if he is his most honored guest. He says, kill the fatted calf and prepare for a feast, for my son that was once lost is now found, has returned to us. Third character in the story starts to come into this at this point, and that's the older brother. The older brother responds how? Is he happy to see his brother? No. Should he have been happy to see his brother? Well, his brother was lost and now he's found. He should have been excited and elated by that. Okay, well, let's think about it. And in real reality here, the son had wasted it into the father's inheritance. He'd wasted a portion of the things that they had worked together as children to help accrue and gather and take care of. You know, understandably, there's reasons for the brother, if you think about it on a physical aspect, to be very upset. Think about that older brother as he's standing there watching his father day in and day out, looking down the road potentially for the younger son to come home and seeing how sad he was that the younger son's not there. It hurts to be the one watching that. There would have been no doubt emotions potentially associated with that. But he responds incorrectly here. He responds in a way that he allows, whether it's those emotions that surrounded that or just the pure frustration over him not being elevated for having done the right thing, like the younger brother now is being elevated for having done the wrong thing, we don't know that specific aspect. We do see the father calling his attention to it. My other son was lost and now he's found. Don't have a right to be upset about it. Now, relate this to the Jews. Some degree. Had the Jews been given every opportunity? Okay. Had the Gentiles themselves really had any opportunities? What had they been involved in over and over again in their lives? Riotous living, idolatrous worship. Now, the kingdom was coming, and as a result of that, what was going to be extended to the Gentiles? Salvation, an opportunity. When the Gentiles return home to the Father, Father going to be happy about it? Absolutely. Were the Jews excited about any discussions of the Gentiles receiving any of the whatsoever? Okay. Comments on the parable of the prodigal son? Oh, absolutely. Any other comments? Well, there's no doubt the older brother had pride, and he was very angry about what the younger brother had done. And if you took that same analogy and applied it to the Jews, have they ever said that they've not done it or had... Excuse me. Up here. When they had been confronted with the potential for having committed sin, did they respond that they had done things wrong or that they had done all that God had commanded? They were responding that they had done all that commanded. They were tithing, mint, and coming, and keeping all of this. But Jesus called them on the turf a number of times, said, you neglect the weightier matters of the law. And the eldest brother here, you know, by comparison, the Jews would be in that right. Well, as we start chapter 16, it talks about a cost of stewardship. And this is a parable that really has one point, and really not one of these that's trying to tie together a lot of other things, but I think it's important to tell the story here and get the sense of what this dishonest steward was really trying to achieve. There was a master who found that he had a dishonest steward. Individual he's ready to dismiss because of his actions so that he would no longer be taking care of his affairs. Now this steward had a responsibility evidently for handling all of the master's affairs. He took care of the debts that were due to the master and how those were to be handled. And before he was completely dismissed, he went out to those who owed him or owed the master money and started making arrangements after the master had confronted him initially. What kind of arrangements did he start making? He cut him a deal. That's the best way to word it. Okay, the guy that owed 1,000, he cut it down. And a guy that owed another quantity, he cut it down. And on multiple occasions did this. What was his rationale for doing so? The story tells, you know, I'm looking for a way for somebody to take care of me. If I'll take care of these people now, maybe they'll receive me into their houses themselves, and I won't be destitute. Okay? Well, that's pretty shrewd. Grand scheme of physical things, and you're trying to take care of yourself, he was pretty shrewd about how he was going to go about taking care of himself. That's the whole point of this particular parable. The shrewdness of those that are worldly is often very much so. As he's teaching his disciples, though, the application of this parable is one, you need to take that shrewdness that you may have applied in your prior life, and you take that and apply that to spiritual things. You need to be smart and about how you apply your life to your spiritual things. God will take care of you, and you won't have to be worried about somebody else taking care of you. Other points in his comments to the followers. Use the shrewdness and the diligence you've used in your worldly interests to seek your spiritual goals. Those possessions that were formerly used in an unrighteous manner, and you need to use them now in a righteous manner. These are taken directly out of Bob's comments here, because I felt they best described this parable. Comments to the Pharisees, Jesus made these points. Pharisees justified themselves with the things that they so highly prized were an abomination to God. We've seen that in the parables we've studied tonight about how they sought preeminence, how they set themselves up over others, how they became combative when thought about the inclusion of the Gentiles. Second point, they considered themselves to be the custodians of the law. We've made this point already earlier. We've kept all the law, but yet over and over we see that as the kingdom was taught, that they didn't choose to recognize all of the law. Okay? And the last part, while it's true the law could not fail in one tittle, yet in their lives the Pharisees commonly broke the law. And he makes the specific point about the divorcing of their wives. And that's the same point that's made in Malachi and how that they were treating their wives. They were divorcing the wives of their youths and taking new wives without cause. Any comments?
That's all about words.
Okay. Anything else? I appreciate your comments today. Thank you.